The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
What do you do? Something cold?
Good morning, everybody. On behalf of Dean Claudio Grossman, the faculty, staff, and students of American University, Washington College of Law, I'd like to welcome you to today's event. My name is Hadar Harris, and I'm the executive director of the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law here at the law school. On June 29, 2006, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in the Hamdan versus Rumsfeld case, declaring the Bush administration's decision to try detainees at Guantanamo Bay and military war tribunals illegal. In Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, the court ruled that the military commissions do not comply with U.S. military law, the laws of war, or the Geneva Conventions, which protect the rights of detainees during wartime. We'll be hearing much more about the decision in more detail in a few minutes. But it's important to note that the landmark decision marks the second time the country's highest court has ruled to check the power of the executive branch in its execution of the war on terror. In 2004, Hamdi versus Rumsfeld case, the court ruled that the White House does not have a blank check to indefinitely hold and deny legal access to detainees who are U.S. citizens. The Hamdan decision is an important development in the court's reassertion of its power and its responsibility for judicial review. As anyone who has read the paper, listened to the news, or woken up bravely in the morning to NPR has heard, the issue of military tribunals is high on the agenda of the Congress and the Bush administration. Pending legislation which would set up a revised model for military commissions in which to try detainees at Guantanamo is expected to be voted on in Congress by the end of the week. Indeed, a new draft of that legislation was just released last night, so we've had a little huddle this morning to talk about what that new legislation looks like. Negotiations about that legislation have been going on since July, and the media is reporting wins and losses in the ongoing negotiations as if the tribunals and the balance between national security, human rights, and adherence to U.S. constitutional principles were like a game of Monday night football. And yet, we can't forget that there's much at stake in this debate. Over 400 detainees are at Guantanamo, being held in indefinite detention, most without charges. Many have been there for more than 4 years. Some arrived when still minors. There's no doubt that some of them are not the nicest guys on the block. Some of them are very unsympathetic characters. Some may be terrorists. However, all of them deserve a fair trial and their fundamental right to due process. The Supreme Court has said so in Hamdan, and now Congress and the executive branch are battling it out to see what it means. We must also stay aware that whatever decisions U.S. political leaders arrive at have broad implications for the way that the rest of the world relates to, understands, internalizes, and projects due process and the right to a fair trial. The world continues to look to the United States for leadership in adherence to, or what they construe as permissible derogation from, widely accepted international human rights and humanitarian law norms. The way that we resolve the issues at Guantanamo will clearly have ripples across the world. So today, we're going to try to make some sense of it all. Our panelists will give us a variety of opinions about the implications of the Hamdan decision, looking at it from the perspective of how it implicates international humanitarian law, what it means for the separation of powers, how it impacts and affects practitioners trying to represent detainees at Guantanamo. After the break, at which we will actually have food, I know you think this is a WCL event without food, how could that possibly be? In the second panel, we're particularly pleased to have a diverse group of practitioners who will discuss from their perspective how Hamdan affects the current debate and proposals to set up a mechanism for bringing detainees to justice. Today's conference is just one in a series of events which the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law sponsors throughout the year. The Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law, in addition to providing students at WCL with practical experience, skills building, scholarship opportunities, and substantive education in human rights, beyond the formal law school curriculum, is increasingly partnering and working with NGOs and practitioners in the U.S. and around the world to hold trainings, workshops, and conferences on cutting-edge issues of human rights law and policy. The center holds a unique place between the worlds of the academics and the NGOs. Today's conference is the latest in an ongoing series of events that the center holds, trying to bridge the worlds of academia and activism, theory and practice, and we're pleased to have with us so many leading figures in thinking, talking, and working about using human rights to hold people accountable for what continues to happen at Guantanamo. Just one note before we begin, I want to draw your attention to several upcoming events that I hope that you will join us for. This Friday, September 29th, we'll be holding a all-day conference, starting at 9:30 here in this room on the responsibility to protect the case of Sudan. We have flyers available up on the table in the alcove above. We have an array of speakers coming, again, from a diversity of different viewpoints to talk about the responsibility to protect and particularly to talk about the ongoing genocide in Darfur. On Tuesday, October 3rd, we start the 7th Annual Human Rights Film Festival with the film Amandala, a positive human rights film about the use of music and liberation music during the anti-apartheid era in South Africa. The screenings of the film festival will be every Tuesday night, both at 6 and 8 p.m., usually in this room, every Tuesday night through the month of October. And finally, on Thursday, October 5th, we invite you all to bring everyone you know to participate in a national teach-in on Guantanamo that we will be holding in conjunction with Seton Hall University, who's sponsoring the event. It will be an all-day, into-the-evening event, starting at 11 a.m. and running until about 10 p.m. We'll be having a special panel discussion at noon from our own members of our own faculty who will be talking about some of the work that's being done to represent one of the youngest detainees, which Rick Wilson will talk about later on in the panel. And so it will be a special and interesting day that I encourage all of you to attend and to bring your friends to. A few thank yous, in particular to Amelia Parker, who is an alum of WCL and the new program coordinator for the center, who has handled most of the logistical details for today's event and is looking forward to keeping everything moving along as I go out on maternity leave. Thanks to Jennifer Dabson and the Office of Special Events for assisting with registration and additional logistics. Thanks to the Center's Dean Fellows, Mariam and Dave, for their support. And thanks to Facilities, AV, and Dining Services for providing us with the ability to webcast today's event and to podcast the event, as well as to be able to eat and drink during the event. And finally, thank you to our many panelists who've taken time to be with us today, and many of whom have stayed up very late reading, rereading, and analyzing this new text of the bill now circulating on Capitol Hill to discuss the real-life implications pending today of the Hamdan decision and its implications for military tribunals. At this point, rather than going through the sizable bios of each of our panelists, we've prepared a program which hopefully you've all picked up that have their bios in them. We'll be having Professor Herman Schwartz, Professor Robert Goldman, Professor Dan Marcus, and Professor Rick Wilson speaking about different aspects of the Hamdan decision specifically. Their bios are found in the program. And at this point, I'd like to introduce Professor Herman Schwartz, who will start with an overview of the case. Thank you.
I'm not going to go too deeply into the specifics, specific substantive points. I'm just going to try to give you some background and a summary of the case. The others on the panel will go much more deeply into the specific substantive issues. There are a couple of key aspects to the background here. I think the most significant one of which is the president's desire to govern in all matters relating to what happened September 11th and its aftermath without any check whatsoever. This is based on a constitutional theory that the president's commander-in-chief powers, war powers, and so on. Related to that, both by logical implication and by a desire to avoid a test, is an effort which has been made in every one of these cases and in the placement of people in Guantanamo to keep the courts out of the process. And in every one of these cases, you'll see an effort made. All of the Hamdi case, some of the other cases, the original claim was that the courts had absolutely no role whatsoever, and subsequently that's been modified as the courts have told the president that he can't get away with that. So those are, that's the background of this, and the implications for international law, for separation of powers, and for other aspects, my colleagues on the panel will discuss with you. The story really begins back in November 2001, and with a follow-up in March 2002, where the president issued a military order as commander-in-chief, setting up a system of tribunals for war crimes. Now, you have to keep in mind that there are, running through these things, there have been two issues. The first was whether the president could detain people, and the Hamdi case dealt with that. The second issue, which is what we're dealing with today, is whether or not detainees can be tried for war crimes based before military commissions set up by the president. And that's the issue we're dealing with today. So in this November 2001 military order, the president announced that he was creating military commissions which would try war crimes of various kinds, and that the procedures would be set by the Secretary of Defense, and that the procedure would be entirely within the Defense Department. The appeals would be ultimately to the president, who would make the final decisions. And at the end of this, was stuck on a provision that no court would have any jurisdiction of any kind to review this. And so the president, and then this was, there was a lot of complaints about the kinds of procedures. You could have the death penalty based on a two-thirds vote of the military tribunal and the rest, and it was somewhat modified in March 2002. So there we are. So then, sometime a year or two later, this guy Hamdan was charged with some, at that point, not charged, was told he was subject to charges, unidentified. I think his lawyer pushed the government to specify the charges, and they came up with conspiracy. As it turned out, this guy was not exactly Osama bin Laden. He was Osama bin Laden's driver. But the closest they could come was conspiracy, and the overt acts that were charged was he drove bin Laden, he probably carried some weapons, maybe the gun bin Laden was carrying, who knows. But anyway, though, that was the charge. The case went, now, habeas corpus petitions were filed, by the way, around this time. The case went to trial, and Hamdan won in the lower court, in the federal district court. The court said that the president couldn't do this, didn't have the authority and the like. It went to the Court of Appeals here in Washington. The three-judge panel ruled that the president did have authority. There was a dissent on the Geneva Convention issue as to whether the Geneva Convention applied, and an appeal was cert was applied for in the Supreme Court. On that panel was then Judge John Roberts Jr., who subsequently became Chief Justice, and by the time the case was argued in the Supreme Court last March, Roberts had to recuse himself. Cert was granted November 7th, 2005. And so everybody assumed the court was going to hear it. Meanwhile, some of you may remember that Senator McCain was very upset about the torture allegations. And he attached an amendment to, I think it was the Defense Appropriations Bill or something, called the, which ultimately came to be called the Detainee Treatment Act, in which certain practices he thought would be barred, waterboarding, lengthy sleep deprivation, and the like. The administration fought him on this, and who knows, somehow or other, in addition to this, in this bill that came to be called the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005, passed in December, a month after the Supreme Court had granted cert on Hamdan, a provision was stuck in taking away habeas corpus jurisdiction from all courts, with a very confusing closing decision as to which cases that applied to. Whether and there was a dispute among the senators, Lindsey Graham and others, John Kyle, saying it applied to all cases, all pending cases, before, after the enactment date, or whatever, which would mean that the Supreme Court had no jurisdiction over the Hamdan case anymore, or Senator Levin, who claimed that he had forced a compromise whereby it would not apply to pending cases, only to future cases. So that's the background. It gets to the Supreme Court, and it was argued in March. Chief Justice Roberts not sitting. So it set up a possibility of a 4-4, but also other things. The decision, in fact, turned out to be 5-3, with Justice Kennedy joining Stevens, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Souter. There was a split on one of the issues. What became very clear to those of us who were in the courtroom at the time was that no way was the government going to be able to get away with the argument that this applied to all pending cases and therefore the Supreme Court had no jurisdiction. That was very clear. There were 5 votes for that. And when the government lost that, they then moved to another argument, namely that the courts should wait until all the military tribunals proceedings were over, including appeal to the D.C. Court of Appeals, at which point in about 2 years or 3 years from now, or who knows, maybe 5 years from now, given the pace at which these cases have been moving, you know, Hamdan, I think, took 4 years before they filed the charges against him, that they should wait. The court was unwilling to do that either. So they turned to the merits. The first big issue was whether or not the president had the power to establish military commissions. The government argued he could do it on his own, or and in the alternative, that Congress had given him the power in the Detainee Treatment Act and previously. The court ducked the issue of whether the president had his own power all by himself, and said that, in effect, Congress had recognized a power that he had back in 1916 when it adopted the laws of war, I think, something like that, back then, 1915, 1916, and that they had approved the establishment of military commissions. Okay. But then the question was, what could the military commissions try? What kinds of cases? The government had charged him with conspiracy. The court said that is not a war crime. A military commission can only try war crimes. Conspiracy is not a war crime as we see it. Okay, that was the first issue. Secondly, by what procedures could he be tried? The argument was, and this gets very technical and complicated about relationship to the Uniform Code of Military Justice and how close it had to be to those rules. The court said there were two provisions that it found unacceptable. First and foremost, the fact that somebody could be convicted and sentenced to life and even to death based on evidence that he would never see or hear. That was the first thing that troubled it. And on something that I think Professor Marcus will talk about, they refused to accept the president's finding, such as it was, that it was impracticable to dispense with that right. They also found that the rules on hearsay were no good. As to the conspiracy charge, there was only a plurality. Justice Kennedy didn't go along on that, didn't want to decide that, but he focused heavily on the structure of the tribunal, namely that this was virtually all within the Defense Department. Okay. Secondly, the issue of the Geneva Conventions. The court found, and I'll say this just very quickly, the Geneva Conventions applied, were not complied with. I'll leave that to Bob Goldman to explore. And that's essentially the case. They remanded it. So what you wind up with was a finding that the president does have statutory authority, that conspiracy, four judges said, was not a crime triable by the military commission, but this can be changed. The procedures, all of this was put in statutory terms. However, the language used with respect to the right to see and hear the evidence, the court referred to words like basic right, and to the language in the Geneva Convention about indispensable. So some friends have suggested that there was a constitutional undertone to at least that part of it.
Mm-hmm. Before talking about specifically the findings on Common Article 3, a little bit of context, as I'm going to talk about the international legal aspects that somehow inform the case. You have to keep in mind, and I think that the court was aware, that September 11, certain fundamental propositions that have been consistently argued but are not well known to the American public by the administration, that particularly have been argued before international treaty bodies such as the Committee Against Torture and the Human Rights Committee, as well as the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And the arguments are ones which help to put in better perspective some of these particular issues. First of all, the United States, as you know, took the position that after the September 11 attacks that the United States was at war with al-Qaeda, which is a non-state party. It is a global war without territorial, that is, without territorial limits, without temporal limits, and so forth. The United States has stated that human rights law does not apply to this armed conflict. The United States' position is that human rights law is strictly territorial. It does not apply extraterritorially. Much less does it apply during situations of armed conflict, where the position is that the law of war or international humanitarian law operates as the lex specialis. This position is virtually rejected by every major treaty body in the world, as well as by the International Court of Justice. And we are supported essentially only by Israel in making such claims. The United States also, in the choice of Guantanamo, was very clear because, one, it was extraterritorial in the sense that it was not within the United States territory, therefore human rights law and our obligations under the ICCPR or under the Inter-American Declaration of Rights and Duties of Man and the OAS Charter would not apply. Secondly, The fact is that U.S. criminal law would not apply, and that by calling these people so-called enemy combatants caught in a armed conflict situation, that the president had right under the law of war to detain these people for the duration of the hostilities. Now, one of the things that the Supreme Court did implicitly, Justice Stevens in a majority, was accept the notion that the United States was involved in a war with al-Qaeda. And trying to unravel the ungodly mess that the courts have gotten themselves into goes back to a fundamental issue which none of the courts have really dealt with or dealt with terribly. And that is, if you look at the president's original military commission order of November, I believe, 12 of 2001, it absolutely conflates or equates acts of terror with war crimes. And this is absurd. An act of terror as we understand it, as it is currently understood in international law, such as the taking of hostages, the seizure of civilian aircraft, and the like, attacks against civilians, can occur during periods of armed conflict. And these things are generally treated as serious violations of the laws of war. But acts of terror can also fall outside of situations of armed conflict. You can seize aircraft, you can do what Timothy McVeigh did, you can do what other people did, and there is no situation of armed conflict. International law recognizes two situations of armed conflict: international armed conflicts between or among states, and internal or non-international armed conflicts that occur within the territory of states in a hybrid, such as a mixed or internationalized civil war, such as took place in Angola during the period of the Cold War. The use of the term enemy combatant is a generic term that tells you nothing. Combatants are of two kinds, either lawful or privileged, or unprivileged and unlawful. But combatant status can only exist in the context of an armed conflict. Yet this administration has taken the position that a person who gives material support not just to al-Qaeda, but effectively to any terrorist group, can be designated an enemy combatant and subject to trial and punishment by a military commission. And indeed, during oral argument in one of the cases before, I believe, the Court of Appeals, I think it was before Judge Green, as a matter of fact, one of the administration spokesmen made the claim that a little old lady in Switzerland who gave money to a charity that was a funnel or shell for a terrorist group was an enemy combatant. When you say the word combatant in the context of armed conflict, you are talking about an individual who is subject immediately to direct individualized attack and continues to be subject to attack unless and until that person is captured or taken out of combat by wounds or sickness. And the fact that the courts have accepted so much gibberish that they have not looked at these basic contentions, because you do have some people like Hamdan who were caught during an armed conflict. But you have other people who have been detained and who are being held in Guantanamo who have been captured on no battlefield, but in countries where the United States is not at war. That person cannot, under the law, be deemed a combatant. And to designate an American like Mr. Padilla a combatant meant that when he walked in Chicago in the airport or on the street, he was subject to direct attack. This is nonsense. This is nonsense. And so long as the courts and analysts do not go back to the fundamental flaws in the conception of the so-called war on terror, we will continue to get a lack of clarity. Now, as Herman has said, that the fundamental reason that the court found that the president exceeded authority were the deviations that really could not be justified from the UCMJ, that the administration made no convincing showing and so forth why these procedures that were employed by the military commissions would so deviate. The court could have stopped there, but it didn't. And in many ways, the most remarkable thing that they did was to invoke the law of war, that they found that the Congress had also required that military courts comply with the laws of war, and they found in particular that the structure and so forth of the commission procedures were inconsistent with safeguards established in common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. Now, the administration had argued, and it had been their position, that the conflict with al-Qaeda was an international conflict, but that the Geneva Conventions did not apply because the Geneva Conventions are only open to ratification and accession by states, and al-Qaeda was a non-state actor. Consequently, while it was nonetheless international, the Geneva Conventions did not apply to this armed conflict. The administration also argued that Common Article 3 did not apply to the war with al-Qaeda, as it covers only conflicts of a non-international nature. You can see in the beginning what Common Article 3 states. That would be to civil wars in lesser forms of internal strife. The court disagreed, and it found, through a very literal and somewhat convoluted, in my view, reading of Common Article 3, that it applies to all armed conflicts, not between states. They reasoned that since the war with al-Qaeda was between a state and a non-state actor, it is of a non-international character and thus applies. I say convoluted because, quite frankly, it's a very torturous reading of what Common Article 3 was. Common Article 3 was originally designed, when the Geneva Conventions were negotiated, to be the sole substantive article to apply to internal armed conflicts. States were, in 1946-47, were not willing to engraft the entirety or indeed virtually any part of the law of war to give protections to individuals who took up arms to overthrow or succeed the state. Common Article 3 has been recognized as virtually a convention within a convention. It is pure human rights law, and it essentially does not deal with restraints on methods and means of warfare, that is Hague law, but deals essentially with fundamental human rights that are non-derogable. It prohibits murder, mutilation, torture, outrages upon personal dignity, and most importantly, it also, and I shouldn't say more importantly, it also indicates that you cannot have sentences and convictions that are rendered by courts that are not regularly constituted and afford all judicial guarantees that are recognized as indispensable by civilized nations. Quite frankly, the plurality got it right when they invoked Article 75 of Additional Protocol 1. Because when you talk about torture or outrages upon personal dignity and the like, just as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaims, for example, fundamental, the right to a fair trial, the right to due process, and doesn't spell it out, they spelled it out in the ICCPR. Similarly, any ambiguities concerning the content of fundamental fair trial guarantees that are set forth in Article, Common Article 3, were dispelled and elaborated on when in 1974 through 76, when you got Additional Protocol 1 and 2 in situations of international armed conflict, they elaborated Article 75, and the United States was the principal drafter and pusher of Article 75. And Article 75 exists for persons who do not have protection under other parts of the convention. It is bedrock, just as Common Article 3. Its provisions are non-suspendable under any circumstance. And the fair trial guarantees, by the way, in Article 75 of Additional Protocol 1 are virtually verbatim transcription from Article 14 of the ICCPR's Fair Trial Guarantees for Defendants in Criminal Proceedings. It would have been better, in my view, if the court had used a rationale similar to what the International Court of Justice did in the Nicaragua v. U.S. case in 1986, where, because they didn't want to characterize the nature of the armed conflict between Nicaragua and the United States, they said that the fundamental principles in common Article 3 reflect essential considerations of humanity, irrespective of the character of the conflict. And for years and years, U.S. military handbooks and the Judge Advocate General's handbooks have recognized common Article 3 as providing the essential minimal guarantees that had to be observed in all armed conflicts. It's a far more elegant, and this is a far more reasonable approach, frankly, than the one that the court took. The other things that I would mention, that the court avoided a very important issue that now appears to be settled, unfortunately, if this legislation or the most recent bill goes through. The court avoided the question whether the Geneva Conventions could be invoked by Hamdan or any other person as a source of enforceable rights. If you take a look at the compromise bill, it contains language which is crystal clear that no individual can invoke in any court of the United States, as a rule of decision, any provision of the Geneva Conventions. We are told also that the common Article 3 has been preserved. It has not been whittled down. Take a look again. What has essentially been done in this legislation is, under the War Crimes Act as it existed, it merely stated that violations of common Article 3 were federal crimes. What the draft bill does now is to define what are grave breaches, and that's even a misnomer. There's no such thing as a grave breach. That only applies to international armed conflicts. But I suspect the geniuses who drafted these things in Congress probably meant that it was serious violations of common Article 3. Mm-hmm. What they have done is to expressly exclude the crime of outrages upon personal dignity. And it is very interesting that the ICC contains just such a charge, a substantive crime with both a subjective and an objective element in it. What it means is, and it's not very hard to think about, if you publicly beat a woman or a male, you strip them and you parade them around, you degrade them and you humiliate them and so forth, that would not be something that a reasonable person would be found to be humiliating and degrading. So I suspect we will not be able to complain in the future that if U.S. citizens in war and our soldiers are captured and stripped and paraded around with women's underwear on their head or whatever, or smeared with what appears to be menstrual blood and the like, that this is not going to be a violation of common Article 3. Finally, just as in the Detainee Training Treatment Act, it is clear that our understanding of cruel and human and degrading is not what the international standard is, as it is going to be a standard of unusual, cruel, unusual, and inhumane treatment as prohibited by the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments. And one of the other things that the draft legislation does, which is perhaps unique in the history of congressional enactment, it states, no foreign or international source of law shall supply a basis for a rule of decision in the courts of the United States in interpreting breaches of common Article 3 set forth in the bill. One last thing, and people will be talking about the jurisdiction stripping provisions that are now being examined and were examined yesterday by Senator Specter's committee, that is the Senate Judiciary Committee. It is per se unlawful under international law. In the inter-American system, it has long been held that the fundamental writ of habeas corpus and other such writs, such as amparo, are non-suspendable in emergency situations. There is comparable jurisprudence within by the Human Rights Committee. Finally, the bill will effectively immunize agents of the United States for past violations of common Article 3 as well as human rights law. Now, if passed, this may well be the law of the land. But if I were their lawyers, I would certainly advise them against taking trips overseas once there's a change in administration. Because an amnesty of this kind have been routinely held to be without legal effect, both within other states that have statutes that recognize universal jurisdiction, as well as before international criminal courts. Thank you very much.
Let me just add a couple of footnotes to what Robert Goldman said on the Geneva Convention aspects of Hamdan. One, as he noted, and this is very important, the Supreme Court did not decide the question of whether the Geneva Convention, which is the law of the land of the United States because it's a treaty ratified by the Senate, creates individual enforceable rights in U.S. courts. The way Stevens, and this was one of the cleverest things he did in his opinion, the way he found that the Geneva Convention nonetheless applied in military commission proceedings was that he found that the Uniform Code of Military Justice, a U.S. statute, embodies the international law of armed conflict as a decisional law in the UCMJ, and that the Geneva Conventions are part of the law of armed conflict, and therefore that the Geneva Conventions apply in military commission proceedings. Second thing I'd mention, just as a reminder, Professor Goldman makes the point that the jurisdiction stripping provisions of the provisions that would in effect overrule the Razul decision of the Supreme Court and make it impossible for Guantanamo detainees to file habeas corpus actions in federal district court challenging the conditions of their detention or the legality of their detention, that those provision, that provision violates international law. That, I just want to remind you, that does not necessarily mean that it violates U.S. domestic constitutional law. And Congress, this is an important thing to bear in mind, while a treaty is the law of the land, Congress can supersede that treaty as a matter of U.S. domestic law by a statute, provided that statute is constitutional, of course, and there would be serious constitutional, there are serious constitutional questions about the jurisdiction-stripping provisions of the pending legislation. Okay, let me turn to my assignment, which is the Hamda decision and separation of powers. There's no question that the Supreme Court has clobbered the administration in a number of ways in its three major decisions that it's made in the war on terror. Excuse me, Hamdi, Razul, and Hamdan. But contrary to popular impression, the Supreme Court has not reached the question, and Herman Schwartz made this clear with respect to Hamdan, but it's true of Hamdi too. The Supreme Court has not reached the question of the president's inherent authorities as commander-in-chief in the war on terror in these cases. It has reached another separation of powers question in the Hamdi case, and this is it's interesting because I think the Supreme Court is clearly troubled, I think, by the president's assertions of executive authority in the war on terror, even though it hasn't reached those questions. But it's also been troubled by the president's power vis-a-vis the courts. And there, and I think if anyone who's taken constitutional law and looked at the separation of powers issues has seen that the court is particularly jealous of its own prerogatives and the prerogatives of federal judiciary vis-a-vis the other branches. And in the Hamdi case, the Supreme Court squarely rejected the notion that the president's powers as commander-in-chief during a war are such that the courts are ousted from even deciding whether his assertions of power are constitutional. The administration really suggested in the Hamdi case that the president's power as commander-in-chief rendered his decisions with respect to enemy combatants unreviewable by the courts, and the Supreme Court rejected that in Hamdi. It did not, however, as Professor Schwartz indicated, reach the question of whether the president, if there was no statutory authority for the president to detain U.S. citizens as enemy combatants during a war, whether the president could nonetheless do that as commander-in-chief. As Professor Goldman indicated, for better or worse, it accepted the war metaphor. It accepted the notion that this was a war. And I think looking back, I think Professor Goldman's observation is very interesting, that the war metaphor seemed to make sense to a lot of people at the beginning, because what we were thinking of was that these guys were captured on a traditional battlefield, that is, in Afghanistan, in a war, that regardless of whether the 9/11 attacks were an element of armed conflict, certainly the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan to overthrow the Taliban regime for harboring al-Qaeda was an armed conflict. And therefore, I think we all fell perhaps too easily into thinking of this as a war, and it is striking that the Supreme Court has continued to accept that position. Of course, the war metaphor is used as a sword sometimes by people asserting rights, as well as by the administration in defending its prerogatives. Okay, so in Hamdi, the Supreme Court managed to avoid this difficult issue of whether the president had inherent authority to detain enemy combatants by a construction of the statute that Congress passed right after 9/11, the authorization to use military force against al-Qaeda, as a statute that authorized the president to do the kinds of things commanders-in-chief do in wars, including detaining enemy combatants, and they found that that power extended even to detaining a U.S. citizen who was, in fact, an enemy combatant. They went on to deal a real blow to the administration by holding that the Due Process Clause of the Constitution, which regardless of whether it protects those guys at Guantanamo, clearly protects U.S. citizens, had been violated by the procedures that the Department of Defense had set up or had not set up in Guantanamo, which prevented, let me back up a second. Hamdi was not in Guantanamo. They held that the Due Process Clause required the president to provide an opportunity for a U.S. citizen who was detained as an enemy combatant to have an opportunity to challenge that determination before a neutral decision maker. And that actually, that decision is what led the Pentagon right after the Hamdi decision to go ahead and establish the Combatant Status Review Tribunals at Guantanamo. Now, let me just mention one thing quickly, and that is that the Supreme Court really wanted to avoid the constitutional question because it was not easy to find that the AUMF authorized the president to do this because Congress had earlier passed something called the Non-Detention Act, which said no U.S., and this was a reaction, Congress's guilty conscience after the detention of Japanese American citizens during World War II. Congress passed a law in the 50s, I think, that said no U.S. citizen can be detained except pursuant to specific statutory authority. And it was a hard thing for the Supreme Court to find that the AUMF, which said nothing about detention, qualified as specific statutory authority, but they did. Okay. There is language in the Supreme Court opinion in Hamdi that can be read as suggesting some skepticism as to whether the president has the authority to detain U.S. citizens without congressional authorization, but they didn't decide the question. Okay, let's turn to Hamdan quickly. Hamdan, they avoided the constitutional question the other way. They held that there was a congressional statute in this area and that the military commissions did not comply with that statute, and therefore that the military commissions were unlawful. Well, ordinarily, that would have required the court to then face the question, well, okay, if the president's military commissions that he's established in Guantanamo don't comply with the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the governing statute in this area, does he nonetheless have authority as commander-in-chief in a war to establish any kind of military commissions he wants? And if Congress's statute on this limits his authority, it's unconstitutional. That's a question that was presented, in a sense, by the Hamdan case. But Justice Stevens, and that issue was, I believe, briefed, at least in the lower courts in Hamdan. I haven't gone back to look at the briefs, but a close relative of mine worked on the case, and he says it was in there. I went to the oral argument, as I know a couple of my co-panel members did, and there was a question that the Solicitor General was asked, and he gave an answer which I don't recall, but which Justice Stevens relies on in footnote 23 of the opinion, to say that the government, after he decides the statutory question and says the military commissions are unlawful because they violate the UCMJ, Stevens says, and the government does not argue to us that the president has inherent authority to do this under Article 2 of the Constitution. So that question is still theoretically open. But I think it's fair to say that the Supreme Court, in its opinion, Justice Kennedy concurred in this part of Justice Stevens's plurality opinion. Well, this part is the opinion for the court. It's fair to say that the Supreme Court made pretty clear that it doesn't think the president's perhaps the president, if Congress hadn't legislated at all, might have authority to establish a military commission system that was consistent with other constitutional restrictions. But given the fact that Congress has passed legislation in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the president's Article II powers as commander-in-chief, I think the court hinted, do not extend so far as to allow him to ignore that congressional statute. And I think both Stevens and Kennedy make that clear. They take Justice Jackson's opinion in concurring opinion, his now famous concurring opinion in the Youngstown Sheet and Tube case, as their Bible. And they basically say that even where the president has inherent authority under Article 2 of the Constitution as commander-in-chief, where Congress also has authority under Article 1 of the Constitution, as it did in Youngstown, to pass legislation under the Commerce Clause, or as it does in the case of Hamdan, to pass legislation to establish rules and regulations for the armed forces, and to provide rules for the capture of captures during war and so on, that the president cannot ignore a statute passed by Congress. And Now, I think this is, as those of you who've taken my con law class know, this is sort of one of the great areas that the Supreme Court really hasn't sorted out. But I think the signals here by this Supreme Court are very clear that the war powers of Congress are extensive, and that the where Congress, as well as the President, has powers to act, that the congressional enactment is going to govern in the last instance. My time is about up. I'm going to say one last thing. The real big separation of powers issue that the Supreme Court won't be able to duck unless Congress does the wrong thing and passes an NSA surveillance bill authorizing the President's program is the constitutionality, whether the President has inherent authority to order a domestic surveillance program like the NSA surveillance program that does not comply with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act passed by Congress. Because if Hamdan makes anything clear, it is that the President's argument that the AUMF, the Authorization to Use Military Force, passed by Congress in September of 2001, authorizes him to do the NSA surveillance program notwithstanding FISA, the fact that the exclusivity provision of FISA. Hamdan, I mean, the conclusion that that statutory argument doesn't work is a fortiori from the Supreme Court's decision in Hamdan, that the authorization to use military force doesn't authorize the President to establish military commissions that are inconsistent with the UCMJ. So, of course, there's one other thing that might prevent the Supreme Court from reaching the question of the President's inherent authority, and that is the state secret doctrine, which the administration is invoking in an effort to prevent the courts from considering the legality of the NSA surveillance program. Okay, that's it.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Rick Wilson. It's my honor to represent Omar Khadr, a detainee at Guantanamo Bay. I carry out that work with colleagues here, Professor Munir Ahmed, Professor Christine Husky, and students in the International Human Rights Clinic, both current and past, as well as our military co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Colby Vokey, a Marine who is visiting with Omar as we speak, and Army Captain John Miriam, two military officers with whom I'm proud to work. Omar is a Canadian citizen captured by U.S. forces in July 2002 at age 15 near Khost in Afghanistan. Omar is one of only 10 detainees from the more than 700 who have passed through Guantanamo, and about 450 who are there now, who is charged with crimes and was in pretrial proceedings before a military commission there at the time the Hamdan decision came down and struck down those military commissions. No one at Guantanamo has been convicted of any crime. Let me say that again. No one at Guantanamo has been convicted of any crime. Omar will turn 20 this Friday, and he is now awaiting trial before a tribunal which is still under design in Congress. While all of the evidence for his alleged crimes has been in the hands of the prosecution since his capture in 2002, more than 4 years ago. Let me tell you what I'm not worried about in the implications of Hamdan. I'm not worried about whether war crimes were committed by leaders in this administration in my capacity as Omar's counsel. Second, I'm not worried about whether anyone is civilly liable for damages or other reparations to our client. Third, I'm not even so worried about the particular rules of evidence or procedures, such as hearsay issues, presence in a trial, or secret evidence, because we have responses from within the present scheme of criminal process, both federal and courts martial, that answer those questions. I'm worried about one thing. Will we ever get Omar out of prison in Guantanamo? Life at Guantanamo today is harder than it ever has been. Camp 6, the newest camp, was completed in July, and Omar was moved there. It's a medium security facility that was moved to maximum security status, along with other general security measures that were taken around three events documented in a cover story in the New York Times Magazine not too long ago. First, there was an alleged disturbance or uprising in Camp 4, the minimum security or medium security facility there, in June. Also in June, there were three suicides, characterized by the commander at the camp as an act of asymmetrical warfare by the detainees against their captors. And the detainees are treated as though that were true, however absurd the assertion is. All attorney-client materials were seized by investigators in the wake of those suicides and are still in the hands of those investigators, who allege that the detainees used attorney-client confidentiality as a guise for exchanging messages, or that lawyers are complicit in these acts of warfare. And third, of course, we have the arrival recently of 14 so-called high-value detainees who had previously been held in unacknowledged secret detention centers, including some of the most serious alleged offenders. As the guards at Guantanamo and the JAG lawyers there, the military lawyers there, harden their positions about our visits and our work there, it drives a deeper wedge between us and our clients, not just those who are facing trial by military commission, but all 450 detainees. We teach our clinic students here to focus on case theory, and our case theory in Omar's case is simple. This is a case about a boy. That boy has now grown into a young man, but he's still captive to the emotions, the psychological makeup, and the attitudes of a child. That boy has been forgotten by his home government, Canada, while many other allied governments have demanded the release or greater protection for their citizens. There are multiple questions that were not reached in the Hamdan decision. Some have been alluded to by my colleagues. The question of whether any boy or man can be held without a trial at all, for what period of time, and why try him by a military commission if, in the end, the hostilities are endless in the long war on terror, and he can be held for generations if that war is the war on terrorism. Secondly, more specifically, who is a boy under the law of war? Who is a man? And what are the protections to be accorded to a child, traditionally those under the age of 18 at the time of their offenses, who is held and charged with alleged war crimes. There are so many implications of the Hamdan decision that bear study by our defense team that I'm going to suggest only four today. First of all, I think our experience there suggests that we need to know the framework of law that's going to be applied by the presiding officer in the wake of Hamdan. And I'm not sure we have a good answer to that. The framework of the World War II Commission cases seems to have been put to rest by the Supreme Court. The Quirin case, Yamashita, and Eisentrager all seem to be almost as passé as eight-track tapes, overtaken by modernity. Will the customary law of war apply to the benefit of Omar, or the direct application of treaties to his benefit, particularly the Geneva Conventions in their entirety? We'll have to wait to see. Rules of court-martial, or so-called commission law, as we learned last time, seems to focus on the bizarre and the mundane. Rules adopted by the presiding officers themselves that required us not to refer to Omar by his first name, but as Mr. Cotter, or the accused, and forbade us to chew gum or tobacco in open court. Second, what crimes will Omar be charged with? The charge of conspiracy seems to be vulnerable, as you've heard from the other panelists, extremely vulnerable, with four votes against it and one justice who was disinclined to reach the issue at this point. Some of the other charges against him, murder, an attempt murder by an unprivileged belligerent, also seem vulnerable under the same analysis. Is his membership in Al-Qaeda, as alleged, if proven, a crime in and of itself, or is it collective guilt by association similar to that which bars conviction for conspiracy? Third, what broad procedural framework governs these trials in terms of the rules of the Geneva Conventions? Professor Goldman has made a powerful case for the application of Article 75 of the First Optional Protocol, and I might note that Article 75 is surrounded by similar provisions that protect, first, the right to the protection of the family unit in Article 74, and the rights of children generally in Article 77, both of which the U.S. government has agreed to be expressions of customary international law. And fourth, and finally, what about the admissibility of evidence obtained by torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of a boy? And what about the admissibility of the statements made against him by any other of the more than 700 co-defendants, detainees at Guantanamo, or even the uncounted number of detainees with Omar during his first 3 months of detention at the U.S. military base at Bagram outside of Kabul? For this, we have almost no information whatsoever. So I leave you with these questions that we are asking ourselves, to which the law may come up with answers, some answers, but which will leave us with many tasks in the road ahead. Thank you.
At this point, we have about 15 minutes for questions and discussion. So if you have a question or a comment, please come to the front where the microphones are. You may have to switch them on. And please identify yourself and your affiliation.
Hello.
That's on.
Good morning. My name is Harley Mai. I'm a student here at American University. And I wanted to ask if there was a concern about ex post facto laws, considering they've had these crimes and wrote them and have so much information for so long, and now they're rewriting the rules, and how that's being reconciled with the fact that there are new types of crimes being committed, perhaps some that didn't exist before. Thank you.
I'll volunteer to go first. There certainly is a substantial constitutional question presented by Congress creating new crimes and then having people prosecuted for having committed those crimes before Congress passed the statute creating the crimes. So if Congress, I believe, I haven't looked through it yet, but I believe the compromise bill that the administration negotiated with McCain et al. Contains a new crime of conspiracy. I say new, I'm begging the question there, I guess. At least a new explicit federal crime of a crime under the UCMJ of conspiracy. And if that law passes, and if Mr. Hamdan continues to be prosecuted by the military authorities at Guantanamo, he will be able to squarely raise the issue of whether that statute can be retroactively applied to him. It obviously cannot, and then the courts will have to decide the question, the military commission tribunal first, and then the reviewing court will have to decide the question of that the Supreme Court did not decide in Hamdan, and that is whether conspiracy is a crime under the law of armed conflict. And if Justice Kennedy gives Justice Stevens his the fifth vote, presumably when it gets to the Supreme Court, if the same justices are still there, the Supreme Court will hold that Mr. Hamdan cannot be prosecuted in a military tribunal for conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Hello, how are you? My name is Juan De Luca. I am an LLM student, and I have a simple question, I guess. What, in your opinion, what do you think is the image that the United States is reflecting to the international community with all these, the way they are treating this case?
The view of the United States and the international community?
What the international community thinks of the United
right.
States.
Well, Juan, I think you have an idea of that, the answer to that question. I think certainly for those of us who travel often or go outside of the United States, it's pretty clear that the view of the international community is extremely critical. And I think that's reflected in some of the decisions by international treaty bodies and other tribunals that have been mentioned by Professor Goldman. I think there's absolutely no doubt that there is a question in the international community about the...
Is that Berlusconi dialing? And maybe
about the views of that community towards the United States. So I think that's quite a straightforward question.
Let me just add something to that. For 1 year, I held something of a unique position within the UN system as their first so-called independent expert on terrorism and human rights from 2004 to 2005. And I recalled I was in Geneva at the time in 2005 when the United States introduced a resolution condemning torture, and there was huge outburst of laughter by the delegates. I had occasion to meet with, as you could imagine in that position, many people from foreign ministries of our closest allies and those who were not so close. And the view was one that was not particularly flattering. all of the leaked memos, the Bybee memo and so forth, the parsing of language, whether you want to call it the legalization of a policy of extreme cruelty or of torture, has really undercut the ability of the United States to raise these issues, which we always were able to do, despite other policies that we might have followed. If you talk off the record to people from the International Committee of the Red Cross, and they raise issues of torture with other countries, one of the things that are told them and told others, well, when you get the Americans to stop, then we'll stop. The United States was in a position for years to be able to raise, with the Fujimori government in Peru, for instance, the use of secret military tribunals, who, by the way, had probably better procedures than the ones originally envisioned by the United States. And we complained when Rios Montt in Guatemala was trying people by military courts, or Mubarak, or elsewhere. And now Mubarak has basically said, you know, these things are good. The Americans are doing it. Don't criticize us. And so we have really undercut our ability to raise these issues. And it's going to take a long, long time, I think, for us to recover the kind of standard bearer position that we had in the international community. So it's had a severe impact.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
I understand that only a handful of detainees were brought before the military commission, before the Supreme Court stopped the military commission. And I understand that theoretically, every detainee faces the CSRT tribunal, the combat status review tribunal. And that initial tribunal seems to be the pivotal moment in these detainees' lives. It's the tribunal, I understand, at which is determined whether they're subject essentially to indefinite detention. And at these tribunals, they don't have lawyers. In fact, according to the tribunal rules, they shall not have lawyers. Mm-hmm. At these tribunals, the government members of the tribunal will be examining evidence that detainees don't see, etc. Why is our society focused so heavily on the military commissions when it's these tribunals that seem to be so pivotal in the vast majority of the detainees' lives? Is it just that Hamdan came down? Is it just that we understand military commissions better? Why do you think this is?
Well, the fact is our society wasn't terribly focused on military commissions. Our society isn't focused on much of anything, as it happens. And the CSRT, actually there, if it turns out that those are in some way affected by judicial decisions, then the people who are concerned, which means the administration and people in Congress, not very many more beyond that, except for the usual suspects, there are two cases right now that have been sitting for over a year, coming to different conclusions, opposite conclusions, about the constitutionality of what's happening in those CSRTs. One said the detainees have zero rights. They can file a petition for habeas corpus, but they have zero rights. What happens to that, by the way, after this bill is passed, I'm not sure. The other one said that these are grossly violative of all kinds of rights. They've been waiting to be decided by the D.C. Circuit, I think, for probably close to a year,
I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we don't know.
Yeah.
And,
I was just going to add, I think one thing that I think it's a very good question, and it really points to two things, one, both of which Professor Goldman mentioned. One is it points to the problems with the war metaphor here. I think that when the Supreme Court decided Hamdi, of course it was focusing on the rights of a U.S. citizen, but even there, it indicated you didn't have to have a full-fledged bells and whistles independent proceeding to review the enemy combatant determination. It may well be that what they're doing in Guantanamo isn't adequate to satisfy the Supreme Court as a matter of due process. But I think what led us in that direction of thinking, maybe not us, but I mean led people to think this was okay, was, again, the war metaphor, the notion that, well, gee whiz, in a war we routinely detain POWs for the duration of the war, and then they get released. The only problem is this war never ends. And so the whole problem of indefinite detention is not something that the law of war and the Geneva Conventions really contemplated, because historically wars never lasted more than a few years. So I think that's the central problem. But given the fact that the administration is asserting the right to detain these guys until the war on terrorism, the war on militant Islamic jihadism or whatever, however they now define it, is over, and it ain't going to be over for a long time, I think the CSRT thing is just critical.
Let me add another thing here, because I think you can't talk about this devoid of the compromise bill and something that is going to clearly go through. These review proceedings were a direct response to Rasul, mm-hmm. because the United States failed to conduct what we had done in Vietnam in the last Gulf, the first Gulf War in 1992, and these are to convoke what are known as Article 5 proceedings under Article 5 of the Third Geneva Convention, since over the objections of military lawyers, Secretary of State Powell, we decided, for instance, in the case of the Taliban, that the Third Geneva Convention applied, but it really didn't apply, and that there was a separate war with Al-Qaeda that was ongoing, and they were clearly not entitled to presumptive prisoner of war status. So in effect, what they did is they, after the fact, 4 years later or whatever, they had this procedure that is very similar to what you would have in proximity, in time, scope, and so forth on a battlefield, where they separate people, said, no, okay, you're all right, go. In doing that, you made an assumption in your statement, which I think in light of the legislation is not going to be the case. What if you have a determination, and this has already happened, that an individual indeed is not an enemy combatant? But then they say, okay, and obviously you're not going to appeal that, would you? I mean, even assume you could go to the district court. What are you going to appeal a favorable decision for? And even then, under the previous legislation, it was extremely limited. What the right, in other words, it was mostly not de novo finding, but essentially did they conform to the procedure. If that's the case, and you're not certainly going to be tried by a military commission if you're not an enemy combatant, we will assume, then you say, okay, let me go. And they say, no, we still think you're dangerous. If you don't have habeas corpus, effectively what we have legalized is what we've complained about over the world for years. We have created executive administrative detention. And like Dan said, and you may have people who were picked up outside of a battlefield, a recognized battlefield in the sense of humanitarian law. What is the relevant hostilities? Is it the end of fighting? Well, last week the color of the month was fascist Islamism. Is it going to be fascist Sunniism, fascist Shiitism, Al-Qaeda? It's like in Korea, if you're captured and the Korean War ends and you say, well, let me go, and they said, no, you can't go. Why? Because the relevant hostilities are to the end of the Cold War. I mean, what are the relevant hostilities here? What are the relevant hostilities if you were picked up in Bosnia and you were sent to Guantanamo, where no armed conflict exists?
This is something truly out of Kafka. And if you cut off any kind of habeas, people are virtually going to be found to have not been enemy combatants, and they are not going to be released, not to say about any other person who could be found an enemy combatant and therefore has these particular procedures. So, as I said, these things that were done basically to frustrate the decision in Rasul, since it was fuzzy to get the majority in terms of whether it could still be military, and this was going to satisfy it, but you're absolutely right in terms of this is not a judicial proceeding at all. It doesn't even have the minimum safeguards of any kind of judicial proceeding, and had we applied and used what the military wanted, and not the civilian lawyers at Justice and so forth, or the vice president's advisors, who, to the best of my knowledge, were not great authorities on the laws of war, we wouldn't have gotten ourselves probably in this position in the first place.
Okay. I have to say something, too, since everybody else has spoken. Jamie, you in your question, you asked about could be subject to the CSRT process. Everybody there, in fact, all 700, have been subjected to that process. So all of them have been found to be enemy combatants under the CSRT process, except the 14 who recently arrived, who they have announced.
Not all of them. The Uyghurs, the Chinese who can't go back.
No. But they went through the process.
Oh, they went through the process.
Went through the process, were subsequently determined through this ARB process not to be any longer dangerous. That we're talking about the Uyghur Chinese group. I got it covered, you guys. The 14 recent arrivals, the high-value detainees, will be subjected to this process, they tell us, in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And that's, when they talk about tribunals that they will be subjected to, they're talking about the CSRT process. So when you read in the paper about that, that's the tribunal they're talking about, not military commissions, not trial. The Uyghur, the Chinese Muslims who were found to be no longer dangerous, some of them were taken to Albania. A few sit there in limbo, unable to be returned to their home country, China, and unable to enter the United States by order of a judge in the United States who declined to allow them to enter the United States because he ruled that it was outside of his authority to permit that entry, in that is governed by immigration processes that he has no ability to intervene in this situation. So everybody has been subjected to that process, including the 300-plus who have been released, presumably still dangerous, but have been released apparently without incident, except for the tiny, tiny handful who are alleged to have returned to combat.
At this point, we're going to take a break. I would like to thank all of our panelists for their insight and their clear explanations of a rather complicated case and its implications. We will break until 11:15. There are refreshments, muffins, bagels, dessert bars up in the alcove. Please help yourself, and we'll come back to reconvene at 11:15 with our second panel. Please join me in thanking our panelists.